I can eat a page for hours.
Do you want lunch?
You're A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P.
I can't talk too long. I gotta poo.
Oh, no, not the bees! Not the bees! Ah!
It's like looking in a mirror, only not.
Hello, 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 everybody, and welcome to episode 2 of Travolta Cage, a podcast about the greatest actors in history. I'm Clint Worthington.
I am Nathan Raven.
And we are joined this week by the lovely Noel Murray. Hello, Noel.
I'm lovely. That's nice to hear.
Yes, you are. Why don't you tell the people what you do and where they can find you doing it?
Yeah, I'm a freelance writer. I've been writing about pop culture since the 90s, and you can see my work regularly in the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, the AV Club, and Vulture.
Nice. Any particularly interesting pieces you've written lately?
They're all interesting, Clint.
Oh, of course. Good
which,
answer.
Which are super interesting.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I would say that we're coming up on the end of the year, end of the decade season. So keep an eye on the AV Club in particular. I have a lot of contributions to their best of TV and best of film, end of decade and end of year lists, both the ones that have already run and the ones that are coming up soon.
Excellent. You can tell us Is Loquisha on there.
I cannot speak to that yet.
I have to
keep some secrets.
Leaving us in suspense, I see.
Yeah. Because it would be both racist and sexist to leave the motion picture Loquisha off your top 10 list.
Yeah,
well. a problematic. But for those of you who are just jumping into this podcast now, especially since it's so new, our premise is that we are talking about the respective careers of one, John Travolta and Nicolas Cage. Who Nathan and I think are two of the most interesting, you know, often flawed, often great actors of their generation, roughly.
Messily and compelling, I think.
Messily compelling,
word.
I think, is
to,
very,
to describe
apropos.
The two of them.
And so we're going through their careers in their filmographies in chronological order. And last week we talked about Carrie and Valley Girl, which were two very interesting sort of debuts for them. But now we're talking about Rumblefish, Francis Ford Coppola's movie that he cast his nephew in, and also The Boy in the Plastic Bubble.
Isolated at birth.
Until he develops an immune system of his own, he'll have to remain in his protected environment.
Are we talking about days or weeks or months?
Years.
Trapped for a lifetime.
You don't care what happens to you, Todd. Sometimes I think you want to die.
You're feeling like a hospital case. Like some weirdo kid who can't even breathe normal air because he might get sick and die.
John Travolta is The Boy in the Plastic Bubble, a USA premiere event, tomorrow at 2, 1 Central.
Fun fact, both of these movies came out the same year as the ones we talked about last episode, for the actors, because Boy in the Plastic Bubble came out same year as Carrie, and this came out same year as Valley Girl, I believe.
Yeah. That is certainly true. And one of the reasons why I wanted to have Noel on, beyond him being one of my favorite writers and critics and people in the world, is that you know more than anybody in the entire world about 1970s television, particularly television movies. So could you talk a little bit about sort of the disease of the week as a cultural institution, and then John Travolta, where he was professionally when he made The Boy in the Plastic Bubble?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, in the 70s, movies on television were, you know, considered to be, you know, prestigious in their own separate way. So, like, you know, this was the era of the big new Hollywood films, and TV was trying to compete by producing some films that were more provocative and more artful. And quite a few of them would go on to win Peabody Awards and Emmys, and some of them even, like, for example, films like Steven Spielberg's Duel were good enough that they went on to be played in theaters. So as part of this whole phenomenon, you had what came to be known as the Disease of the Week movie, which the history of that sort of traces back to the movie Brian's Song.
Yeah, I was just about to mention that one. Yeah,
which is one of the most popular TV movies of the 70s. A story about a friendship between two football players, Gale Sayers, the Chicago Bears running back, and Brian Piccolo, his good friend, played by James Caan. And you know, that film kind of exemplifies the male weepy, you know, the film for men that makes men cry. Mm-hmm. And it became a huge success, and you know, success breeds success, and so you had this whole string in the 70s of films with you know, rising stars, or sometimes you know, former movie stars playing these characters who were suffering through some you know, horrible affliction, but suffering nobly.
And what,
teaching us all lessons.
What were the hallmarks of these movies?
Well, typically, you know, the characters would be, you know, we'd see a glimpse of their ordinary life and a sense of what normalcy was, and then it gets disrupted by whatever happens to them, and they pull together and they have a certain noble strength as they get through these difficult times.
Yeah, well, that certainly describes John Travolta and his family in The Boy in the Plastic Bubble. And then this, I feel like Brian's song, like it wasn't just a successful television movie. It feels like this was kind of a pop culture phenomenon. Like, what happened? What was it about this movie other than it obviously being very emotionally juicy? What about it meant to, like, break out of the ghetto of television movies and become something that people are talking about, making jokes about to this day?
Well, you were asking about, you know, the phenomenon of John Travolta. And of course, he's still very early in his career at this point. But, you know, he sort of fits a type, right? I mean, you know, the mid-70s saw kind of a transition in what the movie star and TV star type was. Like, you had these very, very interesting looking, unusual actors that emerged in the late 60s and early 70s. Your Dustin Hoffman's, your Robert De Niro, is your Al Pacino's. John Travolta is kind of like if you took a Robert De Niro or Al Pacino type, but kind of removed the quirkiness and the funkiness and made him a little bit more of a hunk.
Yeah. Added 5 or 6 inches as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I feel like the height is a big part of what makes him so sexy and viral and
Yeah, so I mean, you know, and this, of course, also was an age when you had lots of teen magazines, your Dynamite magazine,
your Tiger Beat,
where, you know, the idea of sexually objectifying men, that it was, you know, more acceptable for young women to you know, see these actors and musicians as dreamboats, oftentimes kind of soft, cuddly dreamboats, and John Travolta kind of fit that mold as well. He seemed sort of both virile and yet in his own kind of way sexually unthreatening.
Well, we kind of saw that in last episode with Valley Girl and Carrie, where both Nicolas Cage and John Travolta are introduced with women leering at them.
Yeah.
It's like the movie is just blatantly in objectifying these characters in a way that's, yeah, kind of fascinating in terms of gender and particularly kind of the era in which these movies were made. And he was a multimedia star at this point because he had television. But then he was also a recording artist by this point as well. Have you heard his any of his albums? Have you heard Travolta Fever?
I have not, no.
Neither have I.
Yeah, well, we'll get around to that, but I'm fascinated.
Maybe those will be Patreon bonuses, which, by the way, I forgot to mention. Please pledge to our Patreon, patreon.com/TravoltaCage. I will let you continue.
Yeah. So yeah, I guess probably now would be a good time to kind of get to the movie proper. Yeah, so we start off with a glimpse of normality. We see the boy in the plastic bubble. I'm sure he has a name. But his parents, they're meeting with their doctor, played by Ralph Bellamy, who gives them the news that she's pregnant, and they've had the situation before where they've had problems. They've had lots and lots of problems. The doctor says, like, no two people on earth were better suited to being parents than you two. But it's obviously a really, really tough row to hoe. And when their new baby is born, it's born without any immune deficiency. Like, it has no defenses. So it has to grow up in this bubble. And one of the things that I found really fascinating about this is originally the problem for John Travolta's character is he likes the bubble too much, I wasn't necessarily expecting that. You figure you have to spend your whole goddamn life in a bubble. It would be utterly, utterly depressing. You would be suicidal. It would be the worst thing ever. But with the case of the boy in the plastic bubble, he's got like a man bubble. He's got a sweet ass bubble that he has tricked out. Were you guys struck by that? By what an incongruously sweet existence he seems to be enjoying, at least at the beginning of this movie?
Well, I guess my first thing was I accidentally watched the wrong movie. I accidentally watched The Boy in the Plastic Bublé, where John Travolta just was in this giant plastic mannequin of Michael Bublé. But eventually I came around and watched The Boy in the Plastic Bubble. And yeah, like, obviously the bubble is metaphorical for a lot of things. It's metaphorical for that sort of adolescent, for also for, like, you know, parental overprotectiveness as well. And but also like that fear of the unknown, you know, where it's like, you know, anything could kill you, you know, because even people who don't live in plastic bubbles have, you know, hypochondria and are worried about the outside world and what's going to do to them. And so that sort of vulnerability, that's that weird combination of security and vulnerability that the bubble provides is really, really interesting, because at once it's guarding him from the dangers of the world, but also it's just plastic. It could pop. Anything could happen to it. It's a very fragile kind of security, which I thought was really interesting.
I think part of the appeal of this film for me, I remember it. I was like 6 years old when the movie originally aired. I remember seeing the commercials. Mm-hmm. It replayed quite a bit in the 70s because Travolta was so successful, but also because it was just, the premise was so interesting. Like you say, the idea that, you know, you live with this little hermetically sealed. How does it work? I mean, how does it literally work to sort of live inside of a habit trail? As a human,
Do you get fed? How does that food get disinfected? You know,
yeah, all of that stuff is just as on a procedural level, it's absolutely fascinating. But I think also as somebody, when you're a kid, I think a lot of us like the idea of building our own little fort, you know, making our own little treehouse or whatever.
There are no girls allowed in the plastic.
It kind of is a clubhouse. It's kind of
that's my point.
Weird science fiction, science fact clubhouse.
Yeah, so I mean that sort of a fantasy element to you know, and you talk, Nathan, about him sort of enjoying being inside the bubble. I think that's part of what it is. There is something kind of nice about being sealed off from the world in your own little space, and he's got everything he needs, you know, in there more or less. It's neat.
Well, and there's this interesting scene where Ralph Bellamy, as the doctor, says to him, like, confronts him. And this is one of the first things that we kind of see from John Travolta once he started playing the character. And he's like, you're using this as an excuse not to grow up and not to mature and not to engage with the outside world. And I'm like, he lives in a bubble. He has no immune system. Cut him some slack. Life is very difficult. But that, in a weird sort of way, is sort of the drama of the movie, is that he's kind of happy literally in his bubble, and he needs to sort of be pushed out of it and to engage in the outside world. And one of the ways that he does this is he is invited to a party by the beautiful, alluring girl next door. And if you're the boy in the plastic bubble, you have an excellent excuse to never go to a party again. You can just RSVP, sorry, I live in a plastic bubble. But the wonderful thing about his life is that he's able to, like, go out in his bubble. It's like a travel bubble. It's like a mobile bubble. It gets around. So he goes, and there's this, like, lovely, lovely scene. Very, very melodramatic, like the rest of the movie. Just wildly, wildly, screamingly melodramatic, where it's the 4th of July party, and all the kids are having fun, and they're drinking, and they're being young people. And then the girl, whom the boy in the plastic bubble has a huge, huge crush on, she says, you know, why don't we hold hands? That's like what people do who like each other. And he's like, oh my God, this is so exciting. I'm going to hold hands with this lady. It's right, unbelievable. Baby. It's literally unbelievable. And then it turns out that she was just pulling a cruel scam on him for the benefit of the popular kids. And we saw the movie Carrie. That was the last movie we talked about last week. Movie that also starred PJ Souls, who is a supporting character in this. And yeah, that's a very kind of fascinating to me because it's so like Carrie. And in this paradigm, sort of John Travolta is the Carrie character. You know, he is the beautiful outcast weirdo who's different and superior and consequently gets bullied and made fun of. So that was kind of fascinating to me. What did you think of that, Clint? Were you struck by that as well, the echoes of Carrie?
Oh, definitely. And I think it's also interesting to point out the connective tissue between, like, his next movie, too, where this was directed by Randall Kleiser.
Yeah, Randall Kleiser.
who ended up directing Grease because Travolta liked working with him on this, and so he had him come on to Grease. Yeah, I did find that very interesting, and as you say that, it makes me wonder, if I had telekinetic powers, would I mind so much living in a plastic bubble? Because then I could just lift myself up in the plastic bubble and just float everywhere like Magneto.
Oh my God, that's so awesome.
Right? I wouldn't want for anything.
I would also like to say that if this movie were made in 2019, The Boy in the Plastic Bubble totally has a podcast.
Oh, totally. It totally does.
You'd have to call in order to be part of it, part of the podcast, but he would definitely have a podcast, the podcast from the bubble. So he's living this life of relative happiness, and then he has a roommate, oddly enough, and this roommate has a very, very different perspective in that he is very, very angry and very pissed off and very depressed that he can't be a part of the world, that he can't get laid, that he can't do all of these things that he wants to do. He does, and that's one of the things that I find kind of fascinating about this. Like, depending on your perspective and how you look at this, this is this very romantic story about, you know, the sort of blessed child who falls in love and seeks truth and beauty and connection and escape. Or it's a story about a teenager who wants to get laid and has some very, very unique, very, very different challenges in order for that to happen. And I think there's a bit of a turn in his character when he meets this other character and kind of realizes, like, I kind of want these things now. Like, I want to get out into the world. I want to experience these things. I want to be a teenager. I don't just be this weirdo living this hermetic life outside.
Well, the thing about the roommate is that he has experienced life on the outside, too, where this is a new thing for him, being in the bubble, whereas Travolta has lived his entire life there. He doesn't know any more about that.
One of his key lines of dialogues are, I want a beard and a mustache and I want to make it with anything that walks. Which is very,
it's just
very
Dennis
honest.
Hopper in Blue Velvet. Yeah, which is fuck anything that moves.
Very, very honest dialogue for a teenager, particularly in this particular situation.
I want to drink Pabst Blue Ribbon.
And there's this nice moment of connection at the end there. We kind of doesn't really get this guy or like this guy. And he's like, He's like, all the time, man. And yeah, it's great where they're able to connect over masturbating.
I'm sure he's glad he has that, like, curtain.
It's actually quite, daring, really, for, like, 1976, I guess is when this movie came out, right?
Talk about
masturbation.
On a TV show. Even in a major motion picture, that wasn't all that common. But to have these kids kind of frankly discussing their wanking habits was quite something.
Yeah, for sure. Exactly. And then I also, I love awkward cameos by real life figures. So I absolutely adored Buzz Aldrin's performance.
Yes, special appearance by. And that's, by the way, quick aside about TV movies. I love that these individual movies have guest stars, as if they are just popping in and won't be here next week.
Robert Reed's not going to be in the next episode of The Boy in the Plastic Bubble. That makes no sense at all.
Can we talk about the parents real quick? I found their journey kind of interesting, just like we talked about with the parents in Valley Girl last week. It's a really interesting look at parenting. Mm-hmm. They're saddled with this incredible responsibility and trying to sort of just power through it, and I loved seeing the cracks of frustration that they had, especially with the mother who was like worried about, you know, the life that her child was going to have. And I thought that Robert Reed and Diana Hyland had some great performances. I think she was nominated posthumously for an Emmy for this.
She won an Emmy posthumously.
I don't know
if you guys know the incredible melodrama behind this, but she apparently was the great love of John Travolta's life.
Which is weird.
Yeah, very weird.
Why? Because she plays his mother and is 20 years older than him?
Yeah, I'm just saying.
So that was apparently like that was the great love of his life. And she died like literally 6 months after this movie was made. So it's very ironic that one of them has, this possibly terminal condition and everything is incredibly fragile and delicate. And that's the other thing that's kind of fascinating to me is that John Travolta is such a, I think I used this phrase before, but such a virile figure. There's this very interesting combination of delicacy and fragility and vulnerability because he has this condition and he like literally can't do all the things that everybody else does. But he also is very healthy in a weird sort of way to the point where one of the key scenes in here is when he's going out in his space suit, which he kind of uses. It's hard to use any other word to describe it. Like, I'm not using it in, like, a mocking kind of way. It just looks like something that from, like, Jodorowsky's Dune. Yeah. And again, you sort of talk about the heightened emotions of...
It looks like the kind of space that you make on a TV budget.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Yeah. But, I mean, you talk about, you know, the heightened emotions of high school and adolescence and feeling like an outsider and feeling like there is something that makes you a little bit different. And then you kind of take that to an almost... comic level of melodrama in this movie where you have somebody who literally looks like somebody from outer space and who sort of tells the kids who are like, man, I don't know if I want to hang out with him. He lives in a bubble and wears a space suit. But he's very good looking. So yeah, that I found kind of fascinating. That sort of science fiction element. There's sort of an element of the man who fell to Earth sort of combined with a high school melodrama.
Yeah, exactly. And then those moments with the spacesuit are really interesting, especially when he tries so hard to fit in with the other kids. Like, there's that when he goes out on the football field with them and has that push-up contest, which, by the way, regardless of his strength, I feel like the spacesuit would be so slippery he should have slipped anyway. But I digress. But yeah, that moment of melodrama where it turns out he, like, ends up using all of his oxygen and he has to, like, run back to his bubble was very, very in keeping with this movie's sort of atmosphere.
Yeah. And kind of this idea, this sort of narrative that he created is that he is a creature from the planet Thermopolis, and that he genuinely is from another world and that he's just kind of visiting this world. And again, I think you're kind of taking this metaphor and also reducing the element of metaphor to it. And then, yeah, sort of as the movie goes on, his yearning and yearning and yearning to be a part of this world just goes stronger and stronger. And he falls deeper and deeper in love with the girl next door, who starts off as a cruel tyrant. And then, yeah, there's an element of pragmatism to their relationship. She's kind of using him. He's very smart. But at the same time, like, he just wants so badly to be part of the world that in the end, and I don't feel bad about ruining a movie that's been out for 43 years, he leaves his bubble physically and goes out into the world so that he can exist. And the true story...
So the dulcet tones of Paul Williams. No,
exactly, yes, exactly. Yes. And it's funny because I just watched the Brady Bunch Variety Hour, which had all sorts of weird overlap with A Boy in the Plastic Bubble, one of which is that Robert Reed is a star of it, as he is here. And it's also just weird to see him acting. It's weird to see him doing good performance. It's also weird because he's a song and dance man. Primarily he's Hofer. So that was kind of fascinating. Yeah, they referenced that on the Brady Bunch Variety Hour. They refer to the boy in the plastic bubble being Barbarino in a bubble. It's only the biggest thing ever. and then on the final episode, Paul Williams is the guest, coked out of his gourd, but he performs the song Hell of It from Phantom of Paradise. Yeah. So it's this amazing moment where this unbelievably terrible TV show becomes awesome and, like, overlaps with Phantom of the Paradise. And yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why The Boy in the Plastic Bubble has endured the way it has, is because it has an unforgettable ending. The story that it was based on, the child died when he was 12 years old.
Yes.
So I kind of feel like if you wanted to follow this, it would be The Boy in the Plastic Bubble died 3.5 minutes later.
Yeah, well, I want to talk about that briefly because, you know, Clint, you were talking about the parents in this movie, and it's interesting to me that in the actual true story, as Nathan says, you know, the real boy, David Vedder, died at age 12. This version of the character is a teenager. So they obviously took some liberties with the story. But, you know, it's relevant to what the movie is trying to do, which is it's in a way, it's about living in the 1970s as a teenager and everything that is out there in the world that parents would love to protect their kids from pot, from sex, you know, from all of that. From Paul Williams, for God's sake. Paul Williams is everywhere.
Lock your doors.
That's right. Yeah, the overbeard, long-haired, leaping gnome that is Paul Williams. So, Nathan, you're talking about the metaphor. I mean that really is kind of also part of the metaphor of this movie, is the idea of, you know, sealing your teenagers off from the mean kids, from the bad influences, from all the things that seemed even more dangerous in 1976 than they might have even in the days of the juvenile delinquents of the 50s.
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, especially this is a post-Watergate America, too, so there's a lot, there's a greater cynicism about what the world can do for you or do to you. So, yeah, there's an even greater temptation to keep everyone in their bubbles.
Well, I was really struck watching it this time around was by how appealing life is in the bubble. And I think that might be part of the point.
I think it's part of living in 2019, though.
Well, and it feels like kind of the concept of living in a bubble was a metaphor that kind of gained traction with this. I feel like this kind of made that a thing.
Yeah, like it worked into the lexicon for sure.
Yeah, 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 for sure. And then, yeah, I want to talk a little bit about the tone of this movie as well, because I kind of feel like this is a premise that if you tweak it a little bit, if you look at it from a slightly different perspective, it's a very dark comedy. And it's very weird and kind of, and I feel like they have to,
Are you referring perhaps to the 2000s Jake Gyllenhaal film Bubble Boy?
I am indeed, which you took this premise and took it in a much darker, weirder direction. I'm also talking about the Seinfeld episode about the boy in the plastic bubble. Do you guys remember that one? Of course.
The Moops. Oh my God. The Moops.
Yeah. And again, I felt like all they had to do for that in order to be absolutely hilarious was just to acknowledge all of this weirdness that the boy in the plastic bubble does not. Because it is a very earnest movie. It's a very sincere movie. I feel like one of the things that unite Rumblefish and The Boy in the Plastic Bubble is that there's no protective irony. They're just not afraid to just be very, very dramatic stories about teenagers and the incredibly, wonderfully, maddeningly dramatic world of being in high school.
Yeah, the characters in both films are very sort of guileless and they feel things very deeply, which is a very interesting. And and going back to the aesthetics of Movie of the Weeks, too, I think the music helps with that very earnest mood. It's that very TV special kind of, like, Mark Snow scored this, which I'm very disappointed this didn't sound more like the X-Files, but, you know.
I did not know that, really, from X-Files.
Because
it's such, I mean, it's such a, I watch everything with the captions on. And
the truth is out there, but it sucks because you're in a bubble.
That's true. Melancholy music is what describes about 40% of
the music. It's pretty much the same score as every TV movie of the week of this era. Like, they all sounded like this to a certain extent.
Yeah, yeah, it definitely hits all of those beats. So what do you think happened to the boy in the plastic bubble after this movie ended? Do you think, as I think, he died a horrible death minutes afterwards? Or can you see a world in which he magically overcomes this and is able to exist in the world outside of his bubble?
I have two different approaches. One is the cynical part of me just gloms the ending of Easy Rider onto this and he just gets killed by rednecks. But also, I can imagine a weekly series where he goes around freeing other bubble boys throughout the country from their imprisonment. Tuesdays at 8 on ABC.
Goes around popping that bubble.
I'm going to be that guy who says, did he actually get out of the bubble, or did he get out of the bubble in his mind? Is this all some kind of, is it a fantasy ending? Think about that for a second.
The bubble of his perspective, man.
That's right.
So I was looking this up, and apparently there is a riff tracks of this, and reading that, I got weirdly insulted. But at the same time, like, this is a movie that would be very easy to make fun of. There are a lot of things to make fun of. At the same time, I feel like it's kind of fundamentally wrong to make fun of it because it is so sincere and because it's about something and it has an emotional heft that I don't know if it necessarily earns. I mean, like, it's a very manipulative, very melodramatic movie, but yeah. There's also just an emotional core of it that, I don't know, it feels weirdly authentic despite how gimmicky and how contrived everything is.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's what melodrama is supposed to do, though. I mean, melodrama is supposed to work on you in these very formulaic ways, but give you that sense of catharsis, right? I mean, that's the function it serves, in the same way that you watch a horror movie to get scared or you watch a comedy to laugh. You know, you watch something like this because it's going to access some part of your emotions that you don't get to access on a daily basis unless you are just sad all the time.
Right. You know, and there's an earnestness to it. Like, I think it's so competent at what it does that, yeah, the idea of sort of riffing on that feels weird, as though, like, the angle of riffing on it is just sort of not meeting the movie where it's at. So, like, I can get, like, because I don't think it fails at what it does. And I think that's sort of the central component of what, you know, sort of a riff tracks might do.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very corny. And yet it's also like extraordinarily entertaining. I mean, the movie is made to be watched. It's made to pull you through the commercial breaks and keep you going until you get to the end. And it functions as it's supposed to function.
Well, and I feel like Randall Kleiser's primary motivation as a director, kind of at memo, is to wring the maximum amount of emotion and melodrama out of every scene. And I think he succeeds. You know, he's made something that's incredibly dramatic, incredibly emotional. And I found it corny and powerful at the same time. Powerful not despite being corny, but kind of powerful because it's so corny.
Right. I think if you meet it where it's at, then I think there's a lot of rewards to be found in it. Like, if you can get on its wavelength, I can't really find a whole lot of fault with it, you know?
Yeah, and again, I feel like there's kind of an artlessness to it that is particularly pronounced compared to Rumblefish, which is nothing but artistry. It's like Francis Ford Coppola stabbing you in the face with artistry for 96 minutes, which might be a good segue for our next film, which is Rumblefish.
Rusty James, if Wilcox looking for you, Rusty James.
Nah,
he says he's going to kill you, Rusty James.
Man, me and you, we could have run this whole side of town if you just gave me a chance.
You know, if you're gonna lead people, you have to have somewhere to go.
I wonder why somebody hasn't taken a rifle and blown your head off.
The motorcycle boy.
You always try so hard to be like your brother, Rusty James.
Hey, my brother's the coolest.
Why do you dislike me so much? I mean, I've always tried to be your friend.
You know, you might have made it a while on the Motorcycle Boys rap, but you ain't got your brother's brains.
Clint, want to talk a little bit about the crazy, crazy, crazy motion picture entitled Rumblefish?
Sure. Rumblefish was released in 1983, the same year as Valley Girl, so it sort of doubles as Nick Cage's film debut, I think, in trailers or something like that. Like, they mentioned Nicolas Cage's film debut, or at least on Wikipedia it does. It says it's the film debut for him, being directed by his uncle, Francis Ford Coppola, following up The Outsiders, which itself was an adaptation of an S.E. Hinton novel, with another adaptation of an S.E. Hinton novel, this time co-written by her with Coppola. And it just sort of, you know, where The Outsiders is a much more accessible, approachable kind of, you know, not family friendly, but like, you know, major audience friendly.
It's relatively family friendly, I think.
Let's do it for Johnny, man. But it is this, you know, much more approachable take on sort of misspent youth and juvenile delinquency and sort of that yearning that happens when, you know, you're a young boy, especially, and you feel the need to lash out at the world or try to find something, find a direction. This is much more avant-garde and takes a lot of stuff from like French New Wave and film noir, all this kind of stuff. And
German expressionism as well.
And yeah, absolutely German expressionism. This is sort of centered around this young rapscallion named Rusty James. And it's not Rusty James, it's Rusty James, who is just this guy who, this young misspent, you know, kid who has rumbles and fights with other gangs in Tulsa. And he looks up to his older brother, who's only known as Motorcycle Boy. Sorry.
The Motorcycle Boy. It's Rusty James, Rusty James, Rusty James, and The Motorcycle
Boy.
Motorcycle Boy yeah. would just be silly. The Motorcycle Boy.
Yeah,
has
you have
dignity.
To have that definite article there. Yes. It's like The Mandalorian. It's not just Mandalorian. The Mandalorian.
Or The Batman.
The Batman. So, yeah, and the Motorcycle Boy, you know, he's been gone for a few months, but he's this legendary figure in this, you know, youth gang life in Tulsa. And, you know, Rusty James especially looks up to him as sort of this, you know, almost like philosopher king, this guy that he looks up to, he wants to emulate so badly. And, you know, he comes back to town, and what follows is essentially this 90-minute tone poem about these two sort of, you know, just sort of interacting with each other. He's trying so hard to get something out of Motorcycle Boy while other aspects of his life turn to shit. And there is this ineffable, inescapable need to escape, like the boy in the plastic bubble. He needs to leave his nest and kind of go out into the world. But the stifling nature of this like violent environment he's in makes him just want to follow the motorcycle boy's footsteps.
Yeah, and the title of Rumblefish comes from something that might be discerned as a metaphor, assuming that you know what metaphors
yeah,
mean, which is that Mickey Rourke's character, the motorcycle boy, who's 21 years old in this, and he's only 17 years old in the novel, which is amazing to me because the idea of his character is to be the most world's most world-weary individual, that he's basically 21 going on 800, you know, that he's lived yeah. through many lives, that he's seen all things, that he, like, sees through reality and life and all of that bullshit. And yeah, like you said, he's a sort of legendary mythic figure, and that's what this story is about. It's about mythology, and it's about living up to something that nobody can possibly live up to. Yeah, and it's also about a kind of this weird instant nostalgia that we have. Everybody in Rumblefish, they talk effusively about this sort of bygone era when all of the Rumbles were righteous and everything was wonderful. And when people beat up each other, it was for good reasons and nobody was on drugs. And then the motorcycle boy left for 2 months. Heroin entered the scene. Everybody got popped up on pills. And suddenly there is no honor left in teenagers fighting each other. And I'm like, well, why was there ever any honor to begin with? And then it's important to...
They want to make Rumbles righteous again, is what
well,
you're saying.
Well, exactly. But I think the idea of, like, you know, if you're a teenage boy, you have this hero worship. You know, you have this need to believe in something, even if it's something very empty and very stupid and very wrong. And the motorcycle boy is continually telling people what you believe in, the honor, the dignity, the heroism of the scene of these Rumbles, like that doesn't exist. Like it's all bullshit. Mm-hmm. And again, there's these weird, interesting things. They talk about going to California to visit his mother. And California in this movie is an idea. You know, it's a place, you can go there, it's a state, but it's an idea, and it's like a very elusive and seductive idea. And
it should be pointed out, the mother left very early, and they're sort of left with this alcoholic, deadbeat dad, played by Dennis Hopper, who's very sort of emotionally unavailable to them.
Yeah, and he's, again, he's also very, very smart, and in this movie, to be smart, to be mentally ill, to be different is to be better than other people.
An acute perception, he calls it.
Yes, an acute perception. So, I was talking about the Rumblefish. That's what I was talking about.
Oh, yeah.
So, the motorcycle boy, he is obsessed with these fish called Siamese fighting fish. And these are real-life fish, just as, you know, the boy in the plastic bubble is based on a real thing as well. And the idea is that if you put them in a tank together, they will get very, very angry and they will kill each other because they're just fighting for the same territory. Life has no meaning. It's just angry, angry, angry. But if
they kill themselves fighting their own reflection,
they do indeed. But if you were, as some sort of giant cathartic symbolic gesture, free these fish and put them into the ocean, the Pacific Ocean maybe, then they would no longer feel hemmed in. They would no longer feel, they would be liberated and they could be free and they could live their own best lives. And there's so many clumsy metaphors and allegories and symbolism.
I don't know what you're talking about, Nathan. And it's not like they just like make the fish like the only color object in an entirely black and white film or something. I forgot
also to mention what makes Motorcycle Boy so special. He's colorblind and has bad hearing. Which here again is kind of a state of grace, you know, kind of being a prophetic figure. And there's something really kind of beautiful and poignant about the film's lack of irony about its lack of cynicism, about its belief that you can just believe in these emotions and believe in them very sincerely, and there's nothing wrong with that, and there's nothing to undercut or subvert that hyper melodrama, this sense of emotions at their highest caliber all the time.
Right, well, and in that respect, you know, going back to Boy in the Plastic Bubble, these are kind of two different ways to skin a cat. This is the same cat, at least, right? Like, you know, these are two films about, you know, young people trying to escape these stifling situations that they're in. Rusty James says at some point, I wonder when I'm going to stop being a kid. And I kind of feel like that applies to John Travolta's character in The Boy in the Plastic Bubble, where there is this arrested development that happens when you are trapped in this cage and you gotta get out.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
I want to speak to this idea of nostalgia that you guys are talking about, the idea that, you know, things used to be better, and can we get back to the time when there were righteous rumbles, right? And of course, you know, I'm sure you guys both know the quasi origin story for this movie, which was that Francis Ford Coppola wanted to make an art film for kids, or at least for teenagers. He basically wanted to use, you know, I mean, if The Outsiders was his one for them, then Rumblefish was going to be the one for me. That old, right. You know, so the old saying that you do, you know, you go back and forth between doing commercial work and doing more artistic work. And so his idea was that he wanted to make...
Jack, meanwhile, was one for no one.
Yeah, good Lord. Don't get me started on that. you know, the idea being that he would make a film that would expose the teenagers of 1983 to, as you mentioned, Godard, you know, to the French New Wave, to... 50s melodrama. I mean, all these things that inspired, that influenced Coppola, that excited him as a young filmmaker. He wanted to take those techniques and bring them to the kids of today, circa 1983, in a format that he felt that they would appreciate, which was a youth picture with Matt Dillon and Mickey Rourke. Now, what he forgot to do was tell a story that the kids of that era might be engaged in, you know, enjoy, and that's kind of where he fell a little short. But the idea was still good, to kind of, you know, show people that you could make something, show the kids that cinema could be aesthetically beautiful, and that there were techniques that they could that could be used, that could do something different than they were used to seeing.
I'm totally with, in terms of nostalgia, there's an incredible nostalgia for pop culture of the past as well. This was very overtly filmed like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which is exactly what you want your model for your teen movie to be. And then sort of the main characters seem very, very overtly modeled on James Dean, Rusty James, you know, the callow, angst-ridden, super intense kid. And then the motorcycle boy seems very, 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 very rooted in Marlon Brando. Particularly the wild one. And apparently, while they were shooting this, their nickname for it was Mumblefish. because literally, Mickey Rourke, he would tell his lines so softly, and he would almost whisper them, that it was almost impossible to pick up what he was saying. And I'd imagine they probably had to do a fair amount of it in post. And I was reading about this, and Mickey Rourke had an interesting thing to say about the character of Motorcycle Boy, which is, he said he kind of approached it from the mindset that this guy was an actor who had gotten very, very tired and exhausted with his role, which makes a lot of sense. I think also there's a certain meta element to it, where I think Mickey Rourke was exhausted with kind of being a teen idolish type thing in 1983. So I think there's an element of cynicism and maybe distance there as well.
Yeah, and I think that definitely fits in with that. Yeah, it took me forever to lock on to sort of what he was doing vocally with Motorcycle Boy. And then I realized, oh, he sounds like Michael Madsen a little bit. Like,
really?
Peak 90s Michael Madsen, you know, that kind of, that laconic, almost barely speaking kind of laconicism. And he's so wearied. He's so self-destructive. I mean, the actions that he takes near the end feel so motivated of a sense of, like, entropy is creeping up on him. And it feels like him returning to Tulsa, to this apocalyptic version of Tulsa, is his way of kind of saying goodbye and trying to impart whatever wisdom he can on Rusty James to try to make sure he doesn't follow in his footsteps, because he knows where they lead and it's nowhere good.
Yeah, oh, definitely. And one of the things that's fascinating to me about Rumblefish is it was released 8 months after The Outsiders. They were filmed back to back with the same crew, and you look back at Nicolas Cage's career. Yeah. Look at your career, like, why on earth wasn't he in The Outsiders? I mean, everybody in the fucking world was in The Outsiders, and his uncle directed it. And apparently he auditioned for some major roles, but did not get them. And can we talk a little bit about his role here as Smokey? Can you talk a little bit about Nicolas Cage as Smokey?
Sure. I mean, it's going to be a similar situation with Travolta in Carrie, where he is very much a supporting character, although Travolta in Carrie is much more important to the plot. Nick Cage as Smokey is just a member of Rusty James's gang, and he kind of operates, you know, he has a few, you know, prominent scenes, but for the most part, he just sort of acts as this sounding board. He's sort of a representative of the gang, and he has one scene in particular with Rusty James where he basically, talks about how he can't really live up to that legend of Motorcycle Boy. And to not even really try, and it would probably kill him to do so. Yeah, it's kind of tough to evaluate his performance. It's very, you know, it's very James Dean cool. It's very tough. If you see glimmers of the kind of effortless cool he'll have in a lot of other younger roles, but he doesn't really let loose in the way you expect some Cage performances.
What's interesting to me about him in this movie is that I feel like his character is defined by having a lot of guile. About being very pragmatic, very conniving, very scheming. I feel like people in this movie are just exactly what they are on the surface, which is part of what makes it so incredibly shallow and superficial in a lot of ways. And that Nicolas Cage's character is relatively unique and that there are multiple layers and that he doesn't let on immediately what's going on in his mind. And he manipulates Rusty James. He's always referred to as Rusty James. And then he steals his girlfriend by finagling, sort of arranging for Rusty James to have an orgy and then to cheat on the girlfriend at the orgy and then to say, hey, you know, your boyfriend Rusty James, he totally cheated on you at an orgy. How about having sex with me? And again, it's very difficult to steal the girlfriend of somebody who looks like a 19-year-old Matt Dillon. But he has not only this beauty, and it really is, he's a beautiful, beautiful man. He has this glorious head of hair. He has this amazing satin jacket that I totally, totally, totally want to have.
Yeah, the Barber jacket's pretty dope.
Oh my God. So, but he doesn't just have beauty, he has brains as well, whereas Rusty James just is a good-looking idiot. Yeah, and that's part of my problem with this movie is I felt like if you had a stronger protagonist, this would be a stronger movie. I just kind of wanted to slap Rusty James around for being such an insufferable little twerp.
Perhaps. But then the rub of it is that that's the whole story, right? Is he has to learn how to be less of an insufferable twerp, or at least find an outlet that isn't the self-destructive violent life. Like, in as much as, you know, we mentioned before that Francis Ford Coppola wanted to introduce the kids to art film techniques, you know, like you said, that's sort of what ends up taking priority. So we'll get these amazing visual standouts, like, you know, Rusty James having an out-of-body experience, floating his body up, you know, his soul floating outside of his body. But then, you know, he gets back in the body and we don't really know much more about him.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I feel like there are so many beautiful, beautiful characters that don't have anything going on inside. That everything here is on the surface, and the surface are so gorgeous. But again, there's kind of nothing there. And we talk about stylization, hyper-stylization. This is a movie where the fights feel choreographed in an unusually musical way. That's because they got a dance choreographer to do the shots here. And they feel like an MGM movie from the 1950s. And that's cool and weird and interesting. And it also kind of takes you out of this story. I feel like with The Boy of the Plastic Bubble, there's this emotional core that just gets to you. And I feel like with Rumblefish, there's just so much beauty and the emotional core just isn't there.
Yeah. I want to get back to Cage real quick. I wrote an article 2 years ago for UpRocks about Nicolas Cage's career in the 1980s, which I find an especially fascinating stretch. And obviously you guys are just starting, you know, on this journey. So you're going to have a lot more 80s Cage films, you know, still to come. But the premise of my article was that you know, Nicolas Cage grew up around his uncle Francis and grew up in this era, this new Hollywood era that I was talking about before, where all these filmmakers were doing really interesting films and they were all inspired by the Europeans, and that was kind of what seemed like it was going to be his birthright. And then by the time he was old enough to enter the family business and become an actor, it was gone. You know, the 80s came around and those kind of movies were just not being made anymore. And yet still somehow he managed throughout the 80s to gravitate either to young filmmakers like the Coen brothers or to people like his uncle who were still doing interesting work and try to find ways to be the kind of actor that was no longer on screen in that time. You know, in the 80s, the big stars were more like Tom Cruise, and he wanted to do something a little stranger, a little funkier. And you see kind of the beginning of that a little bit in Rumblefish. He doesn't get to do a lot of the Nicolas Cage stuff that would come later, especially with the next movie he would do two movies later he would do for Coppola when he did Peggy Sue Got Married. Mm-hmm. But he is trying to kind of be a throwback character. He's basically like somebody who has been just pulled directly out of the past. You know, like he was pulled off a shelf he's been sitting there since 1958. You know, on the character actor shelf waiting to be used. and somebody pulled him down and put him into this movie.
Yeah, he's much more of a chameleon here. He's much more willing to fit into the aesthetic of the movie that he's in rather than in his starring roles, a lot of them, you know, the movie itself shaping around Cage's unique kind of persona.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and you would see this in Peggy's Who Got Married, where sort of Nicolas Cage was doing his Nicolas Cage thing, and people were like, who the fuck is this weirdo? And why is he ruining this potentially very great movie? But yeah, I agree with you. I kind of feel like this is sort of the beginning of Nicolas Cage as a character actor, and Nicolas Cage as a charismatic weirdo. Let's talk about some of the other character actors in this movie. This is ridiculously overloaded. We've got Tom Waits. Is very, very good as a billiards place proprietor. Chris Penn doesn't have a whole lot to do. Lawrence Fishburne is very, very good in this. And yeah, I feel like, you know, sort of Nicolas Cage not only holds his own, but I feel like he kind of distinguishes himself in this very, very impressive crowd.
Right. And also Diana Scarwood as Cassandra has a couple really great scenes with Rusty James. You know, there was that one on like the fire escape, which is really, really cool. And yeah, like I haven't heard a lot about her other work, but that kind of cast is really, really valuable to have. I think especially in a movie as sort of obtuse or opaque as this, you really have to rely on really seasoned, layered performers to bring out what emotions there are in what are otherwise kind of one-dimensional characters.
Yeah, Diana Scarwood is very, very good. She plays somebody who is absolutely in love with the motorcycle boy. And the motorcycle boy, you know, as far as he's concerned, in his world, she barely exists. And she is addicted to heroin and one of the many kind of adorably naive sort of adolescent elements of this movie is it's anti-drug in kind of a childlike way. You know, we're like, oh man, things were so good, but now he's on pills and that's going to ruin the rumble if somebody's on pills. But yeah, with Diana Scarwood, you know, she has this heartbreaking monologue where she talks about, you know, I'm not addicted, I just need it. And, you know, if I could only be with Motorcycle Boy, if I could only, like, be connect with him, that I wouldn't need these things. And there's this real sense that if you use drugs, you are weak and sad and pathetic. And people like the motor, or, you know, like Diana Scarwood or Dennis Hopper, and people like the Motorcycle Boy, they don't need these things. They're in, like, a whole different weird world. They're attuned to a special magical frequency that the non-mentally ill are not.
It's like if Jean-Luc Godard directed a film for Dare.
Yeah, sure.
And yeah, we kind of, again, sort of talking about symbolism, incredibly clumsy symbolism. Sort of the climax of this movie finds the motorcycle boy and Rusty James busting into a pet store. Mm-hmm. And because what, you know, the motorcycle wants to do is to liberate the fighting fish so that they can be free and everybody can embrace their truth. And then, you know, getting killed for fish thievery.
It is a capital crime, Nathan. It's yeah. yeah, and then of course, you know, Rusty James takes on the mission and you know, delivers the rumblefish, so-called, to the river so they can be free. One aspect of the movie I just realized we haven't talked about is the score.
Oh god.
We're talking
yeah.
about Stuart Copeland's yeah. music for this, which is so interesting and idiosyncratic, and it clashes with the aesthetic, I think, of the movie in a really fascinating way. It's a very, you know, new wavy, jazz infused kind of, you know, atonal score sometimes. And it's very ambient and it fits with this in really intriguing ways.
Yeah, yeah, it's very percussive as well.
And the song with Stan Ridgway, Don't Box Me In,
yeah,
was one of those sort of great lost 80s tracks. It was like one of those things that, you know, was a very, very minor radio hit when I was alive in the mid 80s. But the kind of thing that got passed around on mixtapes for people who were, you know, people who were cool, who had their copy of the Rumblefish soundtrack, which is the only place you could actually, you know, hear the song.
Yeah, it's crazy to me that there is a scene in Rumblefish set at a video game arcade. Because, again, yeah. I feel like, well, technically, this is a movie that takes place in the present. Other than a video game arcade, almost nothing in this says 1983, and almost everything in it says 1930s, 1950s, 1960s even. I feel like, you know, as we talked about Nicolas Cage, this is very much a film out of time.
Right. There is a fluidity of time here, and I think that's especially borne out in those time-lapse shots too, which were like inspired by Kianoskatsi and stuff like that. So yeah, there is this malleability of time and place.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Do we want to talk about sort of its reception when it first came out and sort of how it ended up getting a critical reappraisal later? Do we have any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously it was not the success that The Outsiders had been. And The Outsiders was you know, not a huge success, but certainly something that Coppola needed at that time in his career, having kind of gone all in on a couple of big projects, which didn't necessarily, you know, pay off as well as he'd hoped. And then after this film, he immediately rolled into The Cotton Club, which was supposed to be his next The Godfather. And it was a notorious disaster that I'm sure Nathan will talk about at length, since he knows that story well, with the whole angle for the late Robert Evans, R.I.P.
Liquid cocaine, baby. Liquid cocaine.
Yeah.
But yeah, no. So, you know, I don't know that it actually has been. If you think I'm wrong here, Clint, but I don't think it actually has been reappraised really all that much. I think people are aware of it, and you know, it had a small. It never had a following. People, I think, admired it in 1983. And it was the kind of thing people would, you know, rent from the video store if they were Coppola fans or film buffs. I don't think it has a big following of people who love it. I think everyone who, you know, it's generally thought of as being an interesting film, but kind of not a totally successful experiment. And I don't know that impression has changed over time.
I feel like it's one of those films that kind of has defenders and it has apologists more than it has outright zealots. It was released by Criterion. I feel like The Outsiders has a huge cult rooted very largely in the book and a lot of the actors and all of those things. I feel like kids are still watching Outsiders these days. I feel like kids aren't watching Rumblefish because it's too fucking weird. I feel like Francis Ford Coppola cultists are watching it. And I feel like it's a very pure movie in a weird sort of way. He's telling a story through images, through emotion. It's an interesting movie. It's friggin' gorgeous. I would give it an award for, you know, production design and cinematography. But yeah, on an emotional level, it just had me rolling my eyes and snorting at the almost over-the-top comic level of earnestness and just unabashed melodrama.
Which is interesting because you'd think those would be criticisms that you'd levy against Boy in the Plastic Bubble.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the parallels are very interesting. So, let's move on to Cage Match. You know, as in our ongoing journey to try to figure out who's better, John Travolta or Nicolas Cage, which is maybe a fool's errand. Maybe we're tilting at windmills, but God damn it, we're going to try. Hmm. Who do you, between these two films, which do you think sort of wins out?
I'm going to give the edge to Boy in the Plastic Bubble, just because I think it's a more enduring film, both in terms of the imagery from it, as Nathan pointed out, has continued to be referenced in other pop culture. And I think the memory of it for people who grew up in the 70s is strong. And, you know, if we're talking about in terms of, you know, Travolta and Cage, obviously, Cage is barely registers at all in Rumblefish, whereas Travolta, this was a career-making performance.
I felt like the Boy in the Plastic Bubble really jumped the bubble in that scene where his girlfriend literally jumps over his bubble in a horse. Oh, good Lord. Yeah, again, I can understand why riff tracks would be like, yes, 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 during scenes like that. But I will also say The Boy in the Plastic Bubble. Rumblefish is a gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous movie, but The Boy in the Plastic Bubble moves you on an emotional level in a way that Rumblefish most assuredly does not.
Right. I'm inclined to agree, at least for the purposes of this competition. I think the edge for me in terms of just how much I like the film goes more towards Rumblefish, just in terms of aesthetics. I really respond to that kind of visuals heavy filmmaking. You know, also I appreciate what The Boy in the Plastic Bubble is doing. I think there's it's very earnest and very on its own level, very sort of upfront about what it's about. And also for the purposes of this competition, perhaps to put my thumb on the scale like I did last week, Boy in the Plastic Bubble is much more a John Travolta movie than Rumblefish is a Nicolas Cage movie. So for the purposes of our, like, you know, ongoing rounds, I suppose, I'm going to give the edge to Boy in the Plastic Bubble itself. So yeah, congratulations, Boy in the Plastic Bubble. You just beat a Francis Ford Coppola movie. Congratulations.
You can leave that bubble and swagger down the street to the zones of staying alive, if so inclined.
Right, right. So before we wrap up, we also want to get into some Cage and Travolta news, right? You've got something up on the pipe, don't you?
Oh, definitely, definitely. Well, yeah, we've kind of noticed how ever since we started doing this podcast, crazier shit has been happening to both of our boys. Cage recently, you know, there were trailers for two of his upcoming movies, one a very, very promising Lovecraft adaptation that marks Richard Stanley's return to filmmaking, the other a wonderfully terrible-looking Kelsey Grammer movie, where he's got the thing about Cage is if he's playing a college-educated person, he's wearing a suit and he's got glasses. If he's playing a scumbag, he's got long hair and a beard.
Yeah, it's a Cameron Poe cosplay.
Exactly, exactly. So it was announced that Nicolas Cage will be playing an unusual role in an upcoming movie. Nicolas Cage will be playing Nicolas Cage in a motion picture entitled The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. This is
the working title of this podcast, weirdly enough.
Exactly. This is what EW had to say about it. Nicolas Cage might be about to take on a role he was literally born to play, Nicolas Cage. Lionsgate is in final negotiations to land Tom Gornikin and Kevin Ann's script, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, which lead character is Nicolas Cage. And the film Cage, who needs money? Wonder where they got that idea. And is creatively unfulfilled. Wonder where they got that idea. Begrudgingly accepts a $1 million offer to attend the birthday of a Mexican billionaire superfan. When things take a wild turn, the Oscar winner is forced to become a version of some of his most iconic and beloved characters. I'm guessing the Family Man. In order to extricate himself from an increasingly dangerous situation. Yeah, this wild. Is from the executive producers of the Fox sitcom Ghosted.
Oh, well, that really moves the needle for me.
For sure. So how do you guys feel about this upcoming Nicolas Cage project?
It feels uniquely Cage, that's for sure. I mean, I think he's a guy who, as crazy as he seems, is very much in tune with his persona and how he's perceived. So I think taking these kinds of weird-ass roles is absolutely up his alley. And, you know, who knows? We'll have to see how the filmmaking bears out, but I think it might be a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, one of my beats writing for the Los Angeles Times is to cover a lot of straight-to-VOD titles for them, which includes a lot of the work of the two gentlemen featured in this in this podcast. I'm referring to Cage and Travolta, not you guys. in fact, just literally 15 minutes before we went on the air here, I got a screener link for the film with Kelsey Grammer and Nicolas Cage that you were just referring to, Grand Isle.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. We should be able to get screeners for that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have that in my possession right now. So, yeah. So I you know, but, you know, I actually enjoy, you know, as far as the ultimate Cage match is concerned, I actually enjoy getting these Nicolas Cage screeners, you know, these Nicolas Cage VOD movies much more than I get than the Travolta ones of late. Yeah. Or the Bruce Willis. There's a million Bruce Willis VOD movies that come out.
Oh, yeah. He'll show up in your movie for like 2 days for, yeah. I think he doesn't even really get paid in money anymore.
Weirdly, Gary Oldman is doing a bunch of these things too. I don't know what's going on.
That's like, winner, Gary Oldman.
You win that Academy Award, then you really want to dive into the world of direct-to-video. It's interesting to me because I feel like you said, Nicolas Cage is uniquely well-suited to this, in part because one of his best performances is it was an adaptation.
Right.
Which is very much a similar project. And my first response to this was like, wow, what an incredibly original movie. That's a combination of adaptation, JCVD, and being John Malkovich. so I feel like there's almost kind of like a weird little subgenre of meta comedies with Hollywood stars playing themselves. And it can be done very, very well in terms of, you know, adaptation or JCVD. The other end of the spectrum, there's Pauly Shore is Dead. I'm hoping that this is, yeah, definitely more adaptation than Pauly Shore is Dead, and it can go either way. I feel like Nicolas Cage is in this really interesting cross-section of his career now where he could continue the comeback and continue to weird, interesting work, or he could slink back into the world of undistinguished direct-to-video movies and never get out of it.
Well, so. I, for one, am personally heartened that this film will be directed by, you know, an absolute contemporary of Spike Jones, Tom Gornikin. So, you know, high hopes.
Do we know what Tom Gornikin has done other than direct this upcoming movie?
I don't know. I presume he directs episodes of Ghosted, maybe?
Sure.
Let's find out real quick. No, I don't know. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't actually matter. No one cares. But yeah, so that's really exciting. Is there any other Travolta Cage news happening, or is that pretty much the big line item?
I think not. Hopefully John Travolta will do something interesting, because
Nicolas
Cage, he's beating him in terms of our patron and our listeners' hearts, and then also in terms of actually doing upcoming things. So.
Right, exactly.
He's got some Comic-Con appearances heading coming up, I'm sure.
Oh, I'm sure. And by the way, listeners, if you want to hear us like review new releases like Grand Isle as they come out, maybe we can make that a Patreon bonus. Like those, maybe those can be subject of some of the Patreon bonus episodes. If we get access to screeners of Grand Isle, we can probably do that. I think that pretty much wraps it up for this episode of Travolta Cage. Noel, thanks so much for joining us.
I had a great time.
Yeah. Once again, where can people find your stuff?
You can look for me most weeks. I'm in Los Angeles Times and in Vulture in various capacities, and occasionally in the New York Times and the AV Club.
Excellent.
And I will say real quick that I mentioned before that, you know, upcoming AV Club best of the year stuff coming up. I will add that if you keep an eye on the worst of the year, you might see a John Travolta film mentioned in the weeks ahead. So keep an eye
I would be angry if a John Travolta film wasn't in the worst. Because, other than Loquisha, I can think of nothing worse than The Fanatic. While also being kind of amazing in its own right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I give you all the support of all five bros. anyway, that wraps it up for this episode of Travolta Cage. Please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, or sorry, Apple Podcasts. iTunes is dead. RIP iTunes. Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever your podcast platform may be. You can follow us on Twitter at Travolta Cage. You can find these episodes proper on NathanRabin.com, as well as Nathan's sort of written project surrounding Travolta and Cage.
Just published the fourth entry in it on Rumblefish.
Oh, yes.
Probably Boy in the Plastic Bubble will be up on Tuesday. You can follow us on Patreon, where we're doing a whole lot more. I've already written two entries, and reading this won't bring back your honey. The Travolta Cage newsletter that I'm very fond of. So please pledge, because I feel like a lunatic posting when we have a relatively modest level of followers.
Right, and you can do that at patreon.com/TravoltaCage. If you want to email us questions, we'd love to get some questions and start answering them at the end of each episode. You can email us at TravoltaCagePod@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you in a couple. Well, what's next, actually, for us, Nathan? What are the next movies you're covering?
So it's going to be Saturday Night Fever and Racing with the Moon, with a very awesome guest, if everything lines up.
Ooh, all right. See you then.